It's my honor to introduce to you Dr. Danny Faulkner. Dr. Faulkner is currently the staff astronomer in the Research Division of Answers in Genesis. He is also a distinguished professor emeritus at the University of South Carolina, Lancaster. Dr. Faulkner reminds me that that was the original USC. He has a bachelor's in mathematics, a master's in physics, and a master's and doctorate in astronomy. He's the author of several books, including Universe by Design, and he's featured in a number of videos. Danny also serves on the board of directors of the Creation Research Society. Before he speaks, I just want to give you a little insight into both of our keynote speakers today. In addition to being world-class scientists, they are just really good human beings also. It's been my privilege to get to know them a little bit. And just to give you an idea of both the intelligence and grace of Dr. Faulkner, he did teach for a number of years at a state university. As you can probably imagine, creation was not high on the agenda there for the university. At the same time, Dr. Faulkner was unabashed in his creationary positions, and the university administration knew that also. Dr. Faulkner has shared with me a few stories whereby some folks wanted to get him in trouble. They knew he was a creationist. Hey, you got this creationist on set. And even though the administration was not predisposed to the creation model, they quickly came to his defense. I also know that with the Creation Research Society, he held a couple conferences there, and Danny was so well known and well regarded by the USC faculty administration that they came and spoke there, even though they did not necessarily agree with the creationary position. So I think that's the kind of influence that good creationary scientists can have in our society. I'm honored to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Danny Faulkner, to you.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
And I want to thank you all for being patient with me yesterday at the book table. I had never run a book table before, and I had difficulty getting the machine running, so we finally figured it out. So again, I thank you for your understanding. This morning I brought reinforcements, so between my wife and me, hopefully we can attend to any thing you want to purchase today. I did want to mention that I have my copies of my book, Universe by Design. It's about cosmology there for sale. I'll be happy to sign those for you as well. Even though I'm not talking about cosmology this conference, it is an important topic related directly to astronomy. And we also have a DVD of me talking about cosmology there as well. So anyway, feel free to peruse and ask questions as you wish. I want to talk today about astronomy's young age indicators, and to really start off, I want to talk about an introduction, the fact that we really have two explanations of how we and the world came to be. There are really only two possibilities. One is that it just happened by itself, and we would call this evolution. And I would define this as a purely natural, purely physical process. Now, if there were evolutionary biologists here today, they would probably object at this point, and they'll say something like, well, it's the variation in gene pool frequency, or some such sort of definition. And sometimes when people criticize some of our creationary ideas and also our critiques of evolutionary ideas in astronomy, they say, well, stars don't have alleles, they don't have genes, this kind of stuff. Well, the problem is biology may be permeated with evolutionary thinking today, but it's not the only science. In fact, it permeates all of human thinking. I want to broaden up the definition. It's not just biological or geological evolution, but also cosmic evolution, astronomical evolution, societal evolution. There's a theory of evolutionary theory of law and of government. And that's a very dominant theory in the world today. And so it's a very broad-based thing, and almost everything's been touched by it. Debate over marriage we're having in this country has touched that as well. If God instituted marriage in the Garden of Eden, then it's his institution provided for us for our benefit. And we trifle with that at our peril. But if it's an institution of human origin, it's evolved with us as a society, then we have every right, we have every responsibility to continue to evolve that institution as well. So even on this fight we're having over so-called marriage equality, it is a fight over evolutionary and a creationary worldview. Make no mistake about it. That's the real important concept behind so many different things today. On the other hand, you have creation. And I wanted to define it just as broadly as I've defined evolution, as evolution is a purely physical, purely natural explanation for the world around us and ourselves. Creation is a supernatural explanation. Now, I've left that broad enough that you could read into that any kind of God or gods that you wish. But I want to be very explicit about it. I'm talking about Yahweh, the God of the Bible here. All right? So that's specifically what I'm going to be talking about. And some people asked, some Christian folks asked, well, is this really important? After all, as long as we love Jesus, what does it matter? Well, I think it really does matter. As the example I just gave you with the marriage debate going on in this country, and it permeates into, again, to ideas dealing with political issues, but also economic and social issues. It colors everything we have. And so I think it is vitally important, particularly for the Christian, to have the proper view upon this. Can you be an evolutionist and be a Christian? I think so. I've known people, I didn't doubt their salvation. They believed in evolution. But I think they've got a very mixed up worldview in all of this. Okay, a matter of time comes up very quickly, because if you look at the evolutionary worldview, it talks about billions of years. If you look at the creationary worldview, well, it doesn't need that. A couple of points I want to make here. First of all, evolution needs billions of years because evolution has to be slow. Well, why does it have to be slow? Well, I look around and I don't see dogs turning into anything else. I don't see cats turning into anything else. I don't see people turning into anything else. So if evolution has happened, the only way that can be to explain the world we see today is that it must move very slowly, so that over many human lifetimes, you don't see it taking place. And so evolution requires billions of years. I think it's impossible to believe in evolution and believe the world is only thousands of years old, even millions of years old. You need more time than that. On the other hand, creation was fast. Why is that? Well, if you really believe in creation, fiat creation, special creation, then there's no great time required at all. God can do it very quickly. By the way, people sometimes ask, well, could God have taken millions of years to create the world? And the answer is, yes, he could have. He's God. But you see, he didn't, because the Bible declares very clearly in Genesis 1 that it was done in 6 normal days. Now, I don't have time to talk about that. I can do a whole talk just on why we believe the days of the creation week were normal days, but there are very good contextual arguments for that. And again, that's for another time. Somebody else probably could do a better job than I could on that, but I've studied it and I'm convinced that if God wanted to let us know he did it in 6 days, he couldn't have done a better job of it. You have to really go out of your way to try to argue otherwise. And so age ought to be a discriminator between the two models of creation and evolution. With evolution, you have to have billions of years. With creation, you don't. In fact, the biblical model suggests very strongly that the creation was just thousands of years ago and it took 1 week. So we look around the world, and can we see some evidences in the world around us that the world is perhaps only thousands of years old? It's certainly not billions of years old. I'll be talking about some of these today, and keep in mind I'm comparing two approaches. One of them is billions of years, one of them is only thousands of years. And if I can provide evidence that the world is certainly less than billions of years old, between those two choices, you've eliminated one and the other one remains. Now, some of these evidences will not say directly, yes, the world is only X thousand years old, but again, it seems to eliminate the great time involved. Now, an evolutionary scientist could stand up here and make a similar argument. He could argue that there are evidences for the world being millions of years old. We as creationists have to answer those. Radiometric dating is one of them that we have to answer and give a counterpoint to. And I think we can do that, by the way. Okay, thousands or billions of years. I've come to realize over the past 40 years, I started college a little over 40 years ago, and I was really getting into studying creation studies there, so I can say I've been studying this for 4 decades. And over the years, I've come to a very strong conclusion. As a scientist, I look at it, and as I love history, too, I look at the history of things, and I've come to the conclusion that your idea that the universe is thousands of years old or billions of years old really has very little to do with physical evidence anyway. It all comes down to what your inclination to start with, what your starting assumptions are. And I'll give you an example of this. Back at the end of the 19th century, geologists and biologists both were thinking that the world was at least, minimum figure, at least 100 million years old. Did they have any evidence for this? They had none. Their entire argument was predicated upon the belief of evolution. They looked around, they saw the animals and plant diversity we saw, and they also looked at landforms with mountains and valleys and canyons and seas and coast, all these things. And it really came through geology first, by the way, and then later on in biology. But they looked at this and they said, you know, going with gradual change, evolution going along at a snail's pace, we can explain the biological diversity and the landforms we see with a lot of time. It's going to take at least 100 million years. Now, that's pretty naive today. Now they're suggesting 4.5 billion years, but back then they weren't ready to push that far. Only 100 million years. The problem was William Thomson, a.k.a. Lord Kelvin, you've probably heard of him. He was one of the most important scientists of the 19th century. In fact, he was probably the most important physicist of the 19th century. There are a couple others that could go toe-to-toe with him, perhaps, but he was stood head and shoulders above them. He died early in the 20th century as an old man. But he had, in the previous decades, latter part of the 19th century, came forth with two very strong evidence that suggested that the Earth and the Sun, hence the solar system, were no more than 30 million years. He did this by looking at what they thought was the energy generation source of the sun's energy at that point, and also the heat loss mechanism for the Earth. Now, people sometimes say, well, your arguments are out of date here because we've supplanted that with nuclear physics and all sorts of things. Well, fine, that's fine. But I want you to throw away that 20th century knowledge and look at it in terms of the 19th century knowledge. And at that time, everybody seemed to agree that what the source of the sun's heat was, and also the history of the source of the Earth's internal heat as well. And Lord Kelvin was able to very clearly show that given the science present at that time, neither the Earth nor the sun could be more than 30 million, with an M, years old. It could be less than that, but it could be no older than that. Notice that they were pushing for 100 million years, which is more than three times longer than that. They offered no evidence for the 100 million years. They simply asserted that on the basis of evolution. So the evidence at the time clearly argued against the long time frame. Yet it didn't deter many scientists. That underscores what I'm talking about here. And so the belief at that point, a little more than a century ago, in an old Earth, billions of years old, or in this case, hundreds of millions of years old, was in spite of, not because of, the best evidence. And I note even my own lifetime, if they want to talk about billions of years, they go to radiometric dating. And to tell you the truth, from what I've studied of it, I'm not impressed with radiometric dating. I really am not. There's a lot of assumption that goes into this and a lot of data manipulation. Again, another talk, probably someone better qualified than I to give that talk. But I've just come to the conclusion over the past 30 years, probably 25 to 30 years, that this idea of about being billions of years has almost nothing to do with the data. And that's a firm conclusion on my part about this. And again, the Great Age was based entirely upon evolution, and it still is. So I get very concerned about creationists, people who believe in some form of creation, but they want the world to be billions of years old. They don't get it. And they don't understand that it's the billions of years doesn't come from the science or the data. It comes from the assumption of evolution. No evolution, you don't need that. You're back to thousands of years, it would seem to me. So again, creation doesn't require great time, and that's the assumption I'm going to make. And I have no problem with the Usher chronology. Some people, you know, get really nervous with that. But I came to the conclusion probably 10 or 12 years ago that you know, some people want to push for 7 or 8,000 years or even 10,000 years, and I don't think you can biblically support that. Do I believe the world was created in 4004 BC? Probably not. But that target date's pretty close. If you look at the assumptions that he made, Usher did. If you believe his assumptions, he actually, that is a good date, by the way. You got to agree with all of his assumptions. Even the late Stephen Jay Gould, an atheist and an eminent paleontologist and evolutionist, wrote an essay back in the 80s where he gave due to Archbishop Usher. He was doing good scholarship at the time. So let's don't diss that man. And creation, it doesn't require great time because it was miraculous. I've come to realize more and more in recent years there's a lot of miraculous involved in the creation week. And God has, again, as I said, revealed his timing there in the creation account. Okay, there are two ways you can approach the question of age and origins. You can start with the Bible, or you can start with science. Now, let me be very careful here about science, because we use the word science two different ways. We talk about operational science. This is the science that works here and now, and we also talk about historical science, dealing with past processes. I'll give you an example, forensic science. That's an example of dealing with the past. And you have all these shows on TV. I think they've kind of waned now, but you had these shows a few years ago. Well, all these crime scene shows they were doing, and they're running the DNA and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of fiction involved in those shows, by the way. Like, for instance, they take a sample, and by lunchtime, that's in the morning, by lunch they get their match. It takes longer than that, quite a bit longer, and it's not as exact science as you might think watching TV. So I get annoyed with these shows. I don't watch them. But, you know, if you want to really reconstruct a crime scene, like, for instance, a person who has been their body has been badly mangled because of the crime committed against them, can you really reproduce that crime scene? No, the body has been mangled. You can replace it with a cadaver, you can replace it with plaster of Paris or whatever, but it's not the same thing anymore, is it? You can't totally recreate it. But operational science, can I recreate an experiment, as it were? That's the whole point of operational science. You can go ahead and go to a lab and do an experiment again and again and again. If somebody publishes a result, I can go to my lab and I can test their results. So it's repeatably testable. The methods of evidence are very different in these two ways of science. Sometimes I hear a statement, disbelieving evolution or believing the world is billions of years old is like disbelieving gravity. Well, excuse me, I can go in the lab and I can test any theory of gravity you want to throw at me. But I can't test how we may have evolved in the past, because it happened in the past. It's historical, not operational. So be very careful. I'm not dissing all of science. I'm not dissing, but maybe 10% of science at this point, and it's the historical aspects of it. And we creationists, by the way, creation scientists, we involve ourselves in historical science as well. We try to put together theories about how light got here from stars, how the flood might have occurred, those kind of things. We have competing models, and I think we need to be a little more humble. We get in big arguments sometimes. We take our own little models far too seriously. Nothing wrong with models as long as you understand it's a model. It's a theory that we need to work out. And sometimes people say the Bible is not a science book. And I'm inclined to agree with that. But it is a history book. People miss that point. The Pentateuch, history. Next 12 books, historical books. You go to the prophetic books. They have history. Of the 39 Old Testament books, you're down to 5 poetic books that are not history. But wait a minute, Job was a real figure, so now you're down to just 4 out of 39 that are not history. 35 of the Old Testament books are historical books. You go to the New Testament, the Gospels, and the Book of Acts, those are all history, and that accounts for probably half of the New Testament. So the Bible contains a tremendous amount of history, and what we're talking about here is history. The billions of years or thousands of years, that's all history. It's not a matter of science per se. So people step over the fact there that the Bible isn't a science book. Well, it is a science. It is scientifically correct, I believe, if you got science properly formulated. But even more important to the point, dealing with historical science, it's a history book, and you better realize that and appropriately apply the standards there. You should. Okay, the length and age of creation. Well, again, I'll sum up my position very quickly here. I'm preaching to the choir, I expect, here. But the creation week was 6 normal days. And the genealogies found in Genesis 5 and 11 and elsewhere in the Old Testament suggest something close to 6,000 years. If you go with the Septuagint, you can stretch it out to 7, but that's about all you're going to get. You're not going to get to 8 or 10 unless you start really doing some work on the text of the Old Testament, which I don't think we ought to do. And so can we find evidence of this? And I think the answer is probably yes. So I'm going to talk about some of astronomy's age indicators. Anybody know what this is a photograph of? Very good. You're a sharp group. I was impressed yesterday that people were able to answer all my questions pretty quickly. Anybody know what this little black dot is? Well, very good. It's one of the moons or satellites passing in front of Jupiter. There's a little black dot. I believe that's Io. It's spelled Io, but pronounced Io. And it's the One of the, well, there are four large satellites of Jupiter. It's got dozens of satellites, but only four that are of any size at all, big ones. These are called the Galilean satellites, Io, or Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. They were called that because they were discovered by Galileo 4 centuries ago. And we had the Voyager probe that went there back in the 1979, and then we had the Galileo probe that went to the Jupiter and his orbit around inside the system, and we've learned a tremendous amount from them. This is a photograph of Io. I always think it looks like a pizza myself. I can see some pepperoni there, and I can see some cheese and tomato sauce, and it's a very colorful world. This color is actually close to the proper color. It's doesn't have any impact craters on it. In fact, it's the only other body in the solar system that doesn't seem to have impact craters on it. And that suggests a relatively young surface, that it's been reworked at some point, the most obvious being geological activity. It doesn't have an atmosphere to speak of, so you don't have wind and water erosion. And those little pits and stuff you see, we believe, are volcanic vents. That was a shock back in 79 when they discovered this. I've got a next image is a black and white, I think, image. It's looped together, but it's a film of a volcanic plume up there on the top of this thing. You can see this, it's looped, so it's going over and over again, but you can see the change taking place there on Io with the with this volcanic material shooting up. And so we've learned a lot about Io. It's when you see this volcanic material, it's not molten rock as we have here on the Earth, the volcanic material. It's actually molten sulfur, as it turns out. What is molten or hot sulfur? Someone said it.
Brimstone.
So I've had the opinion that Io smells like hell. All right, it really does. So I'm not cussing either. I'm just telling you what it smells like. I would not want to go there. It's a really interesting place. But sulfur seems to be some compounds of sulfur, and that's what gives that red and yellow color to it. Sulfur in its pure form is a very beautiful yellow color, but it easily combines into compound form. You get a wide range of different colors, and that's where it comes from. Well, if Io is 4.5 billion years old, where is it getting its heat? The idea was that things formed together, amalgamated from material that came from what they call the pre-solar nebula. Before the solar system formed, most material fell down to form the sun, and then the remaining material flattened to a disk and formed into planets and satellites and asteroids and so forth. And you would have heat that would be generated as these things coalesced and form, but then it would start radiating away that heat. It would take some molten material to the surface where it would cool out to space, particularly with no atmosphere. It would easily lose heat into space. And so you have to ask the question, by the way, Io does appear to be the most volcanically active body in the solar system, more active than the Earth is. It's a much smaller surface, and we've seen as many as a dozen volcanoes launching simultaneously on the surface of the planet. And so it being a much smaller body, it's much more obvious, less surface area to work with. And if you run the numbers, you'll find that in a time scale far, far less than a billion years, Io would have cooled to the point that you would not have volcanic activity going on. Now, if Io is only a few thousand years old, no problem. But if it's billions of years old, you have a problem. So where do you get this heat? Where do you have to generate the heat? Somewhere. You could argue radioactive decay of stuff, but the density of Io is low enough to suggest it has very little radioactive material. Probably would have decayed away long enough ago that what little was there that would be cool now. So in billions of years, it ought to have cooled. And the most common explanation is tidal flexing. This is the idea that as it orbits around the planet, it's tidally distorted as a body is. And it is close to Jupiter, it really is. What Jupiter is going to do is it's going to take Io and take it from a spherical shape to what we call a prolate ellipsoid. It's maybe like a football or a pickle sort of shape. Not quite that extreme, but it's still going to do this. And if you change the distance or the inclination of the orbit, then the thing will relax. It'll flex and relax back and forth like this. Well, if you take any substance and you bend it back and forth, you'll generate heat, dissipate heat. If you take a piece of wire, a piece of metal, you can break a piece of wire if you don't have any wire cutters and you want to cut a piece of wire. If you can bend it, you can bend it back and forth, and then you stress it and it breaks. Before it does that, it gets very warm, doesn't it? That's the theory they have upon this. The problem is it really doesn't work. We had a creation scientist, Wayne Spencer. Anybody familiar with that name? Okay, he's written some stuff on astronomy. He does some good work, and at the last ICC in Pittsburgh, or the one before that, 2003 or 2008, I think 2003, he presented a paper where he investigated this, and he found it didn't work at all. And it turns out the people in the field, evolutionists in the field, kind of know that too, but they don't talk about it too much. The mechanism just cannot generate enough heat to account for that. So as far as I can tell, there is, in a billions of year old cosmology or astronomy, there is no mechanism that can heat Io up sufficiently to do this. So it would suggest to me that either you need a new source, no one knows what it is, or perhaps, hey, it's only thousands of years old. That might be the case. Okay, what's this a photograph of? Okay, again, that's easy to do. Well, be careful, because I'm going to talk about this in a few minutes. All the Jovian planets, not just Saturn, but Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune, all have ring systems now. But Saturn has the grandest one. This, again, was taken, I think, by the Cassini probe, and this is the ring system. Sun's off to the right. This is one of the satellites. I don't know which one it is, but it is one of them. And it's anybody seen Saturn through a telescope before? Is it remarkable? I first looked at it when I was about 14. I had a small tabletop telescope. It wasn't very much. I got up one morning in the late summer or early autumn of 1969, and looked at it. And I didn't know where it was exactly. I knew it was a bright-looking star. And I just pointed to this star and to that star. About the fourth one, there it was. A little tiny thing, but the rings were just unbelievable. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It looked like a little picture, a little painting or something. And I tell people, when I show them Saturn through the telescope, I've probably looked at Saturn 10,000 times in my lifetime. And every one is just as exciting and thrilling as the first one. It's the most stunning thing to see. And you don't need a very big telescope to see it. In fact, it's up in the evening sky now. If you have a telescope, never seen it, and you need some directions, see me later and I'll try to steer you toward it. Okay, this one is... That's Neptune. How can you tell it's Neptune? Kind of a blue color, and there you've got what's called the Great Dark Spot, and you've got some cirrus clouds in it. Uranus and Neptune, I always get confused. Uranus is more of a green color, doesn't have a big dark spot down to the cirrus clouds, but through a telescope, Uranus can look kind of green, and Neptune can look kind of a blue, but you need a good-sized telescope to see that, because it is you can't see with the naked eye. It's a faint object, as far as planets go, at least. Well, the neat thing about the Jovian, but we call these the Jovian planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They're the big four. If you studied astronomy at some point, you know you've got the terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars are close to the Sun, and then you get the others next four farther out. And we call them Jovian because it comes from the word for Jupiter. They're Jupiter-like planets. They're very big. Jupiter is like 11 times the size of the Earth. Saturn nearly 10 times the diameter of the Earth, and Uranus and Neptune about 4 times. So they're really big planets, and the Earth is the biggest of the smaller planets. So these are very large planets. They have a lot of gas in them. What would be gas on the Earth, they're actually liquefied inside of these things, but things such as hydrogen and helium, for the most part, down inside where the pressure is high enough, it condenses into a liquid. Well, what's interesting is three of those planets give off nearly twice the energy that's received from the Sun. We can compute what kind of solar influx there is, because we know how bright the Sun is and how far away they are, and we can determine what the total input of energy is into those, and then we can measure, coming off in the infrared primarily, what energy is given off. And when they discovered this a number of decades ago, it was quite a shock, because they figured the planets were in some sort of static situation where they were giving off as much as they were taking in. Interestingly enough, Uranus doesn't participate in that. Its energy deficit is very meager. I think it does give off a little more than receives, but a modest amount. Why one of the three is like that, I haven't a clue. The secular astronomers who believe in billions of years have a bigger problem, though, because, where does the energy come from? If they're billions of years old, if you look at the structure we think we have, there must be present inside of these planets, you would expect that it would have lost all of its heat already. Again, you could assume that it started with a certain amount of heat, primordial heat, we would say. But if it's only been thousands of years, not a problem. But if it's billions of years old, then you have a problem trying to explain this. And they've tried invoking a settling of material, maybe a little bit of nuclear fission and so forth going inside, natural decay of nuclear or radioactive elements inside. I don't think any of those work. Now, we can say, well, God made them with primordial energy, and that's fine. It would help a little bit if we could explain why God chose to do that and why he chose to do three of them but not one of them. Maybe he was just trying to say, well, here you go, chew on this for a while. Give you a homework problem to figure that one out. I don't know. I would like to have a little better explanation than simply saying that God did it. I think we should be looking for design and what that might incur. By the way, Uranus is a strange planet anyway. Its axis is tilted almost 90 degrees. It actually technically goes backwards because it's tilted a little more than 90 degrees. And its satellites, the large ones at least, orbit in the equatorial plane, so they've been taken with it. And you could explain that by perhaps a late hit in the system. When the thing was forming, a last big body came in and hit it and changed its orientation of its spin. But when you have such a large hit very late, it tends to mess the orbit up and cause the orbit to be elliptical, not being circular. And the problem is Uranus's orbit is one of the most circular orbits in the solar system. In fact, Venus and Uranus have almost perfect circles, more than the Earth does. And yet those are the two satellites that rotate backwards. And so if you look at the rotation of those two, you'd say early, late hit. If you look at the orbits, you'd say no late hit. And it's a real conundrum for secular astronomers. Again, a bit of a conundrum for us. And we could say that God did it that way, but why? But at any rate, I think the energy deficits here, or surpluses, I should say, of the three of the Jovian planets argue very strongly against those being billions of years old. So again, the energy source officially for most astronomers is a mystery at this point. And Lesser Young. All right, this is, I believe, Venus. I haven't reviewed where I got this recently, but my point here is to indicate that there are other planets that have magnetic fields. The Earth has a magnetic field. We've known about that for a very long time. A creationist back in the 60s, I believe, Thomas Barnes, gave an argument that the Earth's magnetic field must be young. We think the Earth's magnetic field is generated by a motion down in the molten portion of the core. The Earth's core is iron and nickel, and there's a portion of it that's solid and a portion of it that's liquid. The outer portion that's liquid, we think, has some eddy currents, some currents moving in it, and being a ferromagnetic substance, it can generate a magnetic field. You need currents of some sort, some sort of charge being carried to produce a magnetic field. The problem is, with time, those currents ought to dissipate. Friction ought to play a role and slowly cause those currents to die out, and after a while the magnetic field's gone. But yet, there it sits. And so Barnes offered many years ago that the Earth's magnetic field should have decayed a long time ago if the planet is even millions of years old, as it turns out, let alone billions of years. We've also found that most other planetary bodies have a magnetic field. Some are stronger than others, some are weaker than others. Interesting, Russ Humphreys, a name you've probably, who's heard of Russ Humphreys here? Okay, pretty well-known creation astronomer. He has the white hole cosmology that he's developed for the light travel time problem. And what he did is he used a recent biblical creation model to try to account for how magnetic fields arose during the creation week. And he would indicate that they would decay over time, but it would take a little while. And on this, he predicted the magnetic fields of Uranus and Neptune. And he did this back in the 70s or early 80s, probably early 80s, around 83 or 84, because we didn't get the first measurement of the magnetic field of Uranus until 1986, and the magnetic field of Neptune until 1989. And he actually predicted what he thought the values would be. And by the way, evolutionary astronomers had predicted their values too, based on evolutionary models. And so when the Voyager probe went past those two planets in 86 and 89 and measured the fields for real, guess whose model predictions the measurements conformed to better? he got it pretty close, and the evolutionary models were wrong. So There is some evidence. You want evidence that, you know, creationists do real science and they make good predictions? Well, there you have it in this. So planetary magnetic fields ought to dissipate over billions of years. The fact that most planets have magnetic fields, appreciable ones, some of them are probably frozen out, maybe remnant fields, but some of these are very active fields yet, and that indicates a recent origin as well. This is a photograph of a ring of one of the Jovian planets. This is one of the ones that are difficult to find, kind of a grainy photo. The outer planets, again, all have rings, but only Saturn has the grand ring. Most of them, Saturn's ring consists of very broad rings or with very narrow gaps inside of them. And the other planets, the rings, they are typically mostly gap with very narrow ringlets in place there. What's going on in those gaps is you have satellites or moons orbiting around the planets that are perturbing the particles making up the rings. The rings are made up of many, many huge numbers of particles, most of them very small, and collectively they reflect light pretty well. But if you got up close to it, you could see through it probably. It's that thin of a veil. These things are probably no more than 100 meters thick. That's how thin these rings are for the most part. And these moons that are farther out, their gravity is pulling, we say perturbing, they're tweaking the particles making up the rings, and they're pulling them out. These places where you have gaps in rings are typically what we call resonances. They orbit, particles will orbit around, say, three times, while a moon orbit around once. We see a lot of that taking place in gravitational interactions throughout the universe. And so the particles are not, the rings themselves are not static, they're dynamic. Particles are being moved around a lot, up and down and up and back and forth and so forth. And over the last 30 years, secular scientists have begun to realize that planetary rings are very temporary structures. They wear away very quickly. They wear away very quickly. They dissipate very quickly. And so if you see a ring system, you know that that ring has not been there very long in order to see it. So they dissipate quickly. All four Jovian planets have rings. Again, only Saturn has a grand one, but the other three ones of the Jovian planets do have rings. And the ring systems are quickly falling apart. A number of mechanisms work on them, gravitational perturbations being one of the greatest, but there are other mechanisms. And over a time span of just a few million years, that's with an M, not with a B, a million years, these ring systems will completely fall apart. Now again, if the solar system is only thousands of years old and the ring systems, you know, maybe formed with the planet or shortly thereafter, not a problem. But if you have a ring, if you have a solar system that's billions of years old, why do we still have ring systems? The rings themselves cannot be billions of years old. That's very clear. They can scarcely be even millions of years old. Well, the usual explanation is that a satellite gets pulled closely to the planet. You have gravitational interactions, those perturbations. You're kicking satellites around too from time to time. And if you get in close enough to the planet, you can have tidal distortions. And remember, I talked about it changing from a sphere to a oblate spheroid shape. And if it starts off being a small satellite, it's going to be kind of potato-shaped to start with anyway. It doesn't have a whole lot of gravity to hold it together. And if you get close enough, the gravity is insufficient to keep it holding together, and it gets shredded into pieces. I believe Professor DeYoung mentioned this yesterday with the origin scenario for the moon and so forth, what they call the Roche lobe. And all that is it's distance from the planet. And all that means is if you have a gravitationally bound object like a small moon or something, it cannot orbit within that range without being shredded apart. So the idea is that satellites are continually being pulled in and destroyed and turned into ring systems. Well, you only have a finite number of satellites to work with. And if you sacrifice these every few million years, after 100 million years, you're out of satellites. And furthermore, how probable is it that we happen to be living at a time where each one of the Jovian planets recently, I'm talking about the last million years or so, shredded a satellite and formed a ring system? These are very transitory things as far as the evolutionary astronomers are concerned, yet we have ring systems in all four of them. It could have happened, yes. What's the probability of that of happening? And I think it's pretty slim, to tell you the truth. So I think that the existence of ring systems strongly suggests a recent origin of the solar system itself, though I don't think this is one of the strongest arguments we could use, because you could play the probability game, as improbable as it seems. You ever notice that evolutionists rely upon a lot of improbable events? You know, just how many improbable events are you allowed to have in your explanation? Okay, what's this a photograph of? Very good, a comet. Y'all heard about comet Ison yet? Well, I'm surprised. It hasn't been picked up very much. It was discovered back last year by, the name Ison comes from a name of a consortium of telescopes operating in Russia. And when they ran the calculations on it, they found out that it's what we call a sun-grazing comet. It causes it to come very close to the sun. And when it does, it gets very bright usually. In fact, this comet Ison has an orbit very similar to a comet seen in 1680. It was called Newton's comet because it was a very important test of his Newtonian theory of gravity and all of this. And the 1680 comet, Newton's comet, turned out to be one of the brightest comets ever. When it swung around perihelion close to the sun, it became very bright, had a very long tail. It was very bright, so bright that some people saw it in the daytime. However, it was only briefly like that, a few weeks, and it was gone. And it turns out the circumstance, not only is the orbit the same, but the circumstances are very similar. And so we expect this comet to reach perihelion closest to the sun on, I think, Thanksgiving Day. And then in early, about that time in an early December, it will be visible both in the morning and the evening sky. So something you want to keep posted on. The Creation Museum near Cincinnati, we just started a planetarium show last week called Fires in the Sky. Anybody seen that planetarium show yet? What are you waiting for? You need to go over there. This planetarium show is about Comet Ison and comets in general. So it's a really nice planetarium show. If you get down there in the next few months, you can learn about Comet Ison. We're going to be setting up a blog for me at the AIG website, and I'm going to be doing updates as we get closer to Comet Ison, so you can check that. But you'll probably hear about it in the news, too. How many of you remember Comet Kohoutek? We hope that this is not another one of those. I keep apologizing for that one. For you kids that don't know about it, just never mind. All right. This is a photograph of a comet. What is a comet? Well, the theory we've had for 60 years is that down here inside the nucleus, down in the coma, the head of the comet, there's what we call a nucleus. It's a chunk of ice and rock a few miles across, far too small to be seen directly in this photograph. Comet nuclei, again, are just a few kilometers, a few miles across. Hale-Bopp, how many people saw that comet? Now, that was a comet, wasn't it? That actually had the largest nucleus ever seen. We estimate around 40 kilometers, or about 25 miles across. That's a monster. Most of them are, you know, fraction of that size. So down in here you have this clump of rock, the nucleus, that's made of ice, various types of ices and dust. And the comets follow very elliptical orbits around the sun. If this is a sun, then the planets are orbiting here in near circles. Comet's orbit goes like this. It comes real close to the sun over here and takes you way far away out here. Now, when the comet is very close to the sun, the heat of the sun's radiation evaporates or sublimes the ices. They become a gas, and it dislodges the dust particles. And it goes out to fill this thing tens of thousands of miles across called the coma. That's that big bright thing you see here. And then the sun's solar wind and the sun's radiation push on the gas and the dust particles and push them away from the sun, giving the dust and the gas tail coming off of the comet. And a comet is brightest when it's near perihelion, closest approach to the sun. So we expect Comet Ison to be brightest on Thanksgiving and a few weeks after that. It's kind of a delay. It's usually brighter right after perihelion passage. Now, these comets go out, and when they get very far away from the sun, like far away as the Earth is, the thing starts cooling off, and it goes farther out in the deep space, way out on the edge of the fringe of the solar system many times. It gets very cold, and we don't see it at all out here. It moves very slowly. It comes in. There's a lot of fireworks just for a brief time when it's closest approach to the sun, and very little the rest of it. Now, remember, the nucleus is very small, which means that it doesn't have a lot of ice and dust to give up. So it turns out comets have very short lifetimes because, number one, they're going to evaporate away pretty quickly. Each time a comet nucleus comes around, it fades a bit. I mean, it loses a lot of material. Next time around, it's not quite as bright. Next time around, not quite as bright. There have been several comets that come, the periodic comets we've seen, over the centuries that are actually fainter than they had been in the past. Most famous comet is Halley's Comet, last seen in 86. That was kind of a disappointment for a lot of people. But the circumstances were very bad that year. So in all the more than 2,000 years of seeing that comet, the circumstances have never been that bad. They conspired. But hang around. In 2050-something, it's coming back, and it's... You planning on not being here? I am. It's going to be spectacular. And the one in the next century, in the 22nd century, is going to be really a humdinger. So hang on for that one, folks. Anyway, they get fainter with time, and some comets have actually completely burned out. There's just nothing left of them to speak of. So very short lifetime in the sense of how many trips you can make around the sun. If you can make it around 75 or 100 times and still have any gas left at all, you're doing really good. And we can calculate how far out it is that a comet can go and still be part of the solar system. And when you take that maximum period you can have and multiply by the maximum number of trips, after just a few tens of millions, maybe even up to 100 million years, comets should all be gone. None. Absolutely none left. Again, if it's only 6,000 years old, that's not a problem. But if it's billions of years old, you have a problem explaining that. But hold on, it's not the only thing that happens, because occasionally a comet will collide with a planet. We knew that could happen in the abstract sense. We had not actually seen that before until 19 years ago, when comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 crashed into Jupiter. Actually, 2 years earlier, when it was coming in towards the sun, it passed close to Jupiter. Jupiter's tidal forces shredded it apart, turned it into about several dozen small comets. It looked like a string of pearls when the thing was first discovered. It then swung around past the sun and came back out. As it went back out, it went back to Jupiter, and this time it smashed into the side. Right there, you can see kind of a black eye. Here's the edge of Jupiter, and this is the black eye left. Unfortunately, the impacts were on the backside of Jupiter, but Jupiter rotates very quickly. So an hour or so after the impacts, it would rotate in. You saw this big black spot on Jupiter, bigger than the Earth. That's how big these splotches were. And again, a small backyard telescope could reveal those. And they were visible for days or weeks. You could see these black splotches. Of course, a month later, Jupiter is no worse for the wear. Had it hit the Earth, it would have been catastrophic, of course. What would have happened there? So we now know for a fact that comets do this. We knew in the past it could happen, but we had never observed such a thing. And we could observe one again in the future. That's a catastrophic loss. That comet's not going to dribble away over many passages. It's gone, never to return, because every bit of it slammed into Jupiter. But there is one other method of losing comets. That's ejection from the solar system. I've mentioned before about those perturbations or tweaks, gravitational tweaks that objects can give one another. Remember I said that comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 came close to Jupiter, had its orbit altered, but is also shredded. But many times comets come just approximately close, not enough to be torn asunder by the tides, but their orbits can be changed, and many times the orbits are shortened. Hale-Bopp came in with a period of 4,200 years and left the inside solar system with a period of 2,800 years. Well, other comets do the reverse. They pick up energy and they leave the solar system on paths that will take them away from the sun, never to return. It's pretty clear they have what's called a hyperbolic orbit. And this has been observed many times, actually. And that, too, is a catastrophic loss. If it's never going to come back again, it's gone for good. So when you put these all together, it's pretty clear that comets can't be primordial. That is, they can't date from the beginning of the solar system. If they did, well, they can if it's only 6,000 years old, let's say. But if it's 4.5 billion, the G there stands for giga year. That means billion years. If the solar system is 4.5 billion years old, we shouldn't see comets at all. Well, this has not escaped the notice of evolutionary scientists. Back in 60 years ago, an astronomer in the Netherlands named Jan Oort suggested what's called the comet, his comet cloud, we call now the Oort cloud. Now, we measure distances within the solar system, what we call an astronomical unit, or AU for short. And an astronomical unit is the average distance between the sun and the Earth. So the Earth is 1 AU from the sun. The most distant planet is 30 AUs. That is Neptune. All right, that's how far away it gets. Well, the Oort cloud is supposed to be a spherical distribution of comet nuclei out there, little tiny spots here and there, and they're out maybe thousands of AUs from the sun. So far out, you'll never see them. And maybe a nearby star passing near the solar system will perturb the orbits. Some of them will be ripped away, but others will be lose energy and they'll fall into the inner solar system. So the idea is that comets are continually being replaced as they die. New ones will die off, they get destroyed, they wear out, but new ones are raining in all the time from the Oort comet cloud. And this is supposed to be the source of long-period comets. Typically, long-period comets have orbits of more than 200 years orbital period, but also their direction they can come from is any direction we say the orbit is inclined, any inclination. So it's not just the length of the period, it's also the time of orbit it has. So it turns out Halley's Comet is a 75, 76 year period, but its orbital characteristics are those of a long period comet, even though it's got a fairly short period. So you could classify Halley as one of those rare exceptions of a long period comet with a fairly short period. Obviously, they'd be perturbed in the past to shorten its orbit up. Then you have short period comets, which have periods typically less than 200 years, and their orbits are pretty close to the plane of the solar system. The Earth and the other planets orbit in about the same plane, and these comets tend to come in on orbits pretty much within 10 or 15 degrees of that plane. And a guy named Gerard Kuiper, about the same time Oort suggested his comet cloud, Kuiper suggested that there was a belt, sort of like a donut shape of distribution of comets just beyond the orbit of Neptune, and maybe the outer planets, Neptune and Uranus in particular, they could tweak the orbits and cause them to fall in and again replace short period comets gradually as they die out and fizzle out. For many years, people kind of ignored the Kuiper belt because they thought that the Oort cloud could feed it all, and then gravitational perturbations would convert long to short period comets. About 30 years ago, they began to find out, they ran computer simulations on this, and they found out that the conversion mechanism was way too insignificant to do this. It would take too long to transform them. So they kind of dusted the Kuiper belt off about 25 or 30 years ago because they needed it badly to do this. Well, do the Oort cloud and Kuiper belts exist? I've got a great quote here. Many scientific papers are written each year about the Oort cloud, its properties, its origin, its evolution, yet there's not yet a shred of direct evidence for its existence. I could have written that, but I didn't. Some of you know who wrote this. Let's ask somebody who thinks they know who wrote it. Anybody want to guess?
Carl Sagan.
That came from somebody who knew, didn't they? Who said that? Okay, it was Carl Sagan. Now, for people a little younger, you may not know who that was, but how many people have heard of Carl Sagan? Okay, a certain age group has to know that one. But Carl Sagan was, he's been dead about 15 years, and he was a very famous astronomer. He was a friend of Johnny Carson's. You young people, ask your parents later who Johnny Carson was. And he was wrote a lot of popular level books. He had a very popular TV show on PBS 30 years ago called Cosmos, one of the most popular shows on PBS ever. Back 30 years ago, you asked the average man on the street, name a scientist or name an astronomer, Carl Sagan would come up immediately. He was a household name. Evolutionary atheist, as far as we know, when he died. By the way, he did hear the gospel before he died. I know a man who did witness to him personally through letters that they exchanged. Very gracious, by the way, Carl was, he said. He wrote this in 1986, and the situation has not changed. Now notice, he says here that it's all these scientific papers are written every year. There's not yet any direct evidence, I would say any evidence for its existence. Now, I always thought that science was the study of the natural world using the five senses. If you can't see it, smell it, taste it, touch it, or hear it, it's not really science, is it? So I would suggest to you that the Oort cloud is not science either. So how can you write a scientific paper about something that's not scientific? I don't get that. Now, you can use scientific principles maybe to kind of project or to speculate about it, but that's what we call science fiction, I thought. But anyway, I mean, what is science? I need to write something up. I've been cogitating this for some time. But what is science fiction? It's a genre of literature where you take scientific principles and you spin a good yarn, don't you? And what is this? The Oort cloud is this thing that you take scientific principles, you spin a nice yarn about. I mean, it's the same thing, isn't it? I think. I don't want to be flippant or be, you know, really caustic about it, but I don't see a whole lot of difference between this and science fiction. What about the Kuiper Belt? Well, 20 years ago, there was an announcement that people have been looking for objects orbiting beyond the orbit of Neptune, where you would expect this to be. And when they found these things, they started finding more and more of them today. There are hundreds of, maybe thousands, probably thousands now of these things out beyond the orbit of Neptune. And this is a very large asteroid belt. There's a second one now, one between Mars and Jupiter, now one beyond the orbit of Neptune. And so some people call these trans-Neptunian objects. That just simply means beyond Neptune. Other people say these are KBOs, Kuiper Belt objects. The question is, are Kuiper Belt objects and trans-Neptunian objects, TNOs, are the same thing? Well, we have the density of at least one. I think now a second one we've inferred. We have to know the size. We have to know the mass. We can get that if it has a satellite. And the density of, they're now saying, people may have been asking, I've talked about Neptune being the most distant planet. You may be wondering what happened to Pluto. I have a whole talk I can give on that. It's another time. But back a few years ago, astronomers decided that Pluto was not a planet anymore. By the way, we demoted a planet back in the mid-19th century. People don't know that, but the first asteroid discovered in 1801 was called a planet for more than 40 years. So no one alive remembers that, but there is historical record. So we've done this before, actually. And I get a lot of third graders upset with me at this point, but I was in favor of demoting it 20 years ago. So I was way ahead of the curve on that one. And I've written up something on this. People think, well, the evolutionists have done it. They've killed the planet. Well, no, evolution has nothing to do with it. And I have a little publication in Creation Matters. That's a publication of the Creation Research Society. And you might want to look for that. Just look for Pluto and my name, and you'll probably get a hit on that pretty fast on the internet. You can check out the reasons that. But my point is here, they're now saying that Pluto, if it's not a planet, it's one of these KBOs, one of the largest. It's not the largest now, by the way. There's one bigger than that now. And it's one of the larger KBOs, or if you wish, TNOs. I prefer TNOs. But we know the density is 2 grams per cubic centimeter. That's a pretty definite measurement made. We know how its mass is because it has several satellites. We know how big it is. We can measure that pretty directly. Now, what I did a few years ago, I went to the known comet composition. What are comets are made out of? And I then began calculating how dense can I make a comet. The comets tend to be very frothy. They've got a lot of porosity to them. But if you compacted it down, squeezed out all the holes, all the air bubbles, if there was air there, what kind of density would you get? And the best I can get is 1.25. That's the best I can get, and probably less than that. So if we think we know what comets are made of, and I think we're pretty good about that, and we know what Pluto's made out of, it's pretty clear to me that Pluto is not a comet nucleus. And so I think there's some real problems out there. There are other problems too, but I'm not convinced at all that these TNOs are actually KBOs. I think the wishful thinking, they look for objects out there and they found them. But you know, Percival Lowell back almost 100 years ago was looking for a ninth planet out there, and he kept looking until he found one, or at least he died by then, but other people did. Just because you find something where you were looking for something doesn't mean it is what you think it is, does it? So even the lesson of Pluto should tell us you may not have found what you think you found here. It may not be a Kuiper Belt object. So I can't stand here this morning and tell you that Kuiper Belt doesn't definitely exist 100%, but I'm pretty convinced it doesn't. I think we're looking at an asteroid belt, not the Kuiper Belt at this point. This is a photograph of Earth and the Moon. Okay, I have a picture together. This was taken by a space probe, I think, one of the Voyager probes, I think, but I can't remember. It captures the size differential pretty well. The moon is 1/4 the size of the Earth. The only problem here is that the light had to be tweaked. As it turns out, the Earth is very bright. It reflects very well. We say it has a high albedo. The moon actually is a very low albedo. The moon, you may think, is really bright, but it's not. It's a pretty dark object. It's almost as dark as coal, believe it or not. It's just the background sky is even darker, and so it looks bright when it reflects all that sunshine. But it really is a dark object. So they actually had to play with this. They had to tweak the moon's contrast up, make it brighter appearing, to make it show up in the photograph at all. Now, yesterday, Professor DeYoung talked about this topic with the title Evolution of the Earth and Moon. I won't belabor the point. He talked about it in more detail. But what happens is a neat interaction, not just the tides being raised, but long-term what happens. As the Earth rotates and the Moon is orbiting it, there's a very interesting interaction taking place so that through time, the Earth's rotation slowly its rotation period slows down, so it's losing energy by rotation. And as it does that, the moon is spiraling outward. It's getting an inch or two farther away every year. And this has been confirmed two ways. They first got it from the ground by comparing historical records of total solar eclipses compared to where it ought to be given the rotation of the period of the Earth. And they also did Apollo experiments where they put reflectors on the surface of the moon, and they can use a large telescope in McDonald Observatory in Texas where they send a laser beam off and reflects off those reflectors and comes back to the telescope. And when they can do this, they can measure the distance to the moon to a fraction of an inch. I find that remarkable. I really do. It's a 500,000 miles there and back. So it's pretty incredible they can do that. But what a wonderful time we live in. Now, as it turns out, they've got to do a lot of data reduction. This thing, as I've looked at it a few times, and it is messy because you see the moon's orbit is, to a good approximation, we know what it is. It's a fixed ellipse, but then it's being tweaked by about 20 different terms. And so the moon's is tweaking and moving around a little bit all the time. We can model those, and we can calculate those. And so when you take all these measurements they've made over the past 40-some years by those reflectors and factor them in with all the little tweaking terms, you end up with a pretty steady 1.5 inches per year or so, come about 4 centimeters, I think, is the measurement per year moving outward. Now, it, as he pointed out yesterday, and as top Professor DeYoung pointed out, it's a very steep function of position. He showed the differential equation there. He solved it. I've solved it after him, and he's got the right number there, clearly. It's not a very hard problem if you've had a few semesters of calculus. And so you can do the calculation, and when you do that, you find out that you've got this, what some people call a Gedanken event as recently as about 1.3 billion years ago. Actually, 1.5 is a really upper limit. I get something close to 1.3 or 1.4, 1.4. There have been some articles in the scientific literature. There was one in Science Magazine back 40 years ago. Where was the moon 4.5 billion years ago? Very good question at this point. They were tearing their hair out over this one because it's pretty clear from the mathematics. We take the current rate. It's a classic differential equations problem, and you get this Gedanken event. But hold on. Long before that, and as you go back in the past, you run into a problem. By the time you go back almost a billion years ago, you're getting tides that are about a mile high. Now, here in Wisconsin, you might be safe, but where I used to live in the Piedmont of South Carolina, about elevation of about 500 or 600 feet, we would be beachfront a couple of times a day, all right? It would be bad, real bad. And yet, there's no evidence in the geological record there were ever tides like that. So you don't have to go back 1.5 billion years. You go back about a billion years, and you run into trouble. And now we're talking 30% at max of the supposed age of the solar system. So again, when you're confronted with 4.5 billion years and a few thousand years, you eliminate one, what's left? So again, does this indicate the Earth is 6,000 years? No, but it seems to eliminate anything over a billion years, it would seem. Okay, this too has not escaped the notice of astronomers. They've come back and they've offered a couple of solutions or suggestions. They've suggested that we live at an unusually high tidal interaction time. That we just happen to be living at a time. You see, we can't really model this. It depends upon the distribution of the continents and how the mantle's arranged. And we just happen to be living at a time where the tidal interaction is huge. Isn't that another one of those coincidences? How many of those are you allowed to have? They argue that For the first 4 billion years or so of the Earth and Moon's existence, there was a tidal lock. The two were tied together so that the moon wasn't moving away and the Earth wasn't spiraling out. And this tidal lock persisted for about 4 billion years. And then about 500 million years ago, it slipped out of tidal lock, and we're having this very rapid tidal evolution taking place now. We're living in an unusually high time for this sort of thing. I presented some of this in a debate sort of format a few years ago to some Christian astronomers. These are people who believe in billions of years. And their response to me was, I said, well, where's the evidence for this? Did this actually happen? And they referred to me to several computer simulations that were done. But where's the evidence? Computer simulations. But what data do you have? Computer simulations. Apparently from our discussion, they didn't quite get what I was saying. They're throwing a simulation out at me and trying to pass that off as fact or data. That's not the way that science used to be done, but it's the way increasingly science, particularly astronomy, is being done. The simulation stands in for real data. You can substitute your simulation you've done on a computer for the data that you're lacking on something. That really distresses me that you're going this direction. I think all a computer simulation proves is the cleverness of the simulator, the person who programmed. You can get a simulation to prove almost anything. So as far as I'm concerned, this problem has not been solved, and there is no evidence. You just throw up a computer simulation. I could throw up one that says, well, it didn't happen that way. Who's to say which happened? All the computer simulation can offer is a plausibility argument or a possibility or saying it could have happened, but there is absolutely no evidence that it actually happened. And is announced really to me at what we call ad hoc, or what we sometimes call special pleading. Special pleading is where you have some sort of event you pull in to as a rescuing device to salvage what you're talking about. Now, if you want to do that, that's fine, but just make sure that you understand, everybody else understands, your audience understands, and particularly in your own mind, you understand that's what you're doing. That's fine. And the question, again, is that science? You know, where's the data? Where are the five senses going here? Anybody recognize this baby? Now, why everybody so tentative on this one? You've been doing so well. All of a sudden, okay, it's the sun. Okay, very good. You can talk about the sun spots that you have there and a limb darkening near the edge. So I want to talk about the sun a little bit, more particularly what's called the early faint sun paradox. We have a very elaborate theory in astronomy that's been developed over the past 50 plus years, a half century of this now, a very robust theory about how stars work and how the sun works. We've had a definitive solar model since the mid-60s, about 45 years, and pretty good stellar models going back that far. And according to our models, there should be a change that takes place inside the sun. I'll very briefly tell you what's going on there for the more scientifically and physically minded people. What's going on there is we think the sun's getting its energy from thermonuclear reactions, and I think there's evidence to support that now. And those reactions will change the composition. You start with hydrogen and you convert it to helium, and you take basically 8 particles and reduce it down to 3 particles, which means you're going to change the number density. If you know the ideal gas law, PV equals NRT, I'm changing the N. As I change the N, you're going to change the PV and the T. And then thermonuclear reaction rates are extremely sensitive to temperature, very steep function of temperature. So if you increase the temperature of the core of the sun where these are going on, you increase the reaction rate, which causes the sun to get brighter. Okay? If you didn't follow any of that, that's okay. All right? I just wanted to throw that extra for people. But that's what the physics tells us. If the sun is operating by nuclear fusion, and I think that it is, then you should gradually increase the sun's brightness over time. Now, again, over a few thousand years, not a problem. It's very gradual. You would only notice appreciable things over many millions of years. And sometimes people, creationists, think, well, maybe the sun isn't getting its reactions, its energy from nuclear reactions. Well, there's a good argument to be made from a creationist standpoint that it gives the sun a tremendous amount of stability. So I think it's a good argument we can make for a recent creation model that it works that way. How much would it brighten? Well, I've run the numbers myself, and you find out that over the past 4.5 billion years since the sun formed, the sun brightens by 40%. Well, hold on. Life has only been around supposedly for 3.5 billion years, so let's ask, that's only what's important anyway. How much has the sun brightened since then? Well, it's brightened by 25% since life first appeared. Now, again, what would that do to Al Gore if we brightened the brightness of the sun by 25%? Well, I read this many times, and finally about 10 years ago, I sat down in my office and I worked on it. It took me about 45 minutes to figure out how to do it, but I did. And when I did, I found it. Oh. That's a killer, isn't it? All right. It would increase the temperature of the Earth by 17 Celsius. In real temperature, that's almost 30 degrees Fahrenheit, isn't it? It may interest you to note that the average temperature of the Earth today is 15 Celsius. Okay, put on your math hats. If the Earth's temperature average now is 15 Celsius, and in the past it was cooler by 17 Celsius, what would that temperature be? Negative 2 Celsius, which in real temperature is about 28 or 29 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the average temperature now. That's the average temperature. What do you think the Earth would be like if the average temperature of the planet was 28 or 29 degrees Fahrenheit? It would be frozen. It would not just be cold. It would be ice, would it not? And by the way, what happens when you have an ice planet? Was it the second Star Wars movie? They had that planet was an ice planet. Remember that one? Hoth? Okay. Once it becomes ice-covered, the sunlight reflects off the high albedo ice, and you can't heat the planet. In fact, it gets colder even more than that. And so according to this, the Earth was once an ice ball. And once it's an ice ball, even as you warm the sun up, brighten the sun up, you're not going to melt it very well. Furthermore, there isn't a geologist or biologist around who thinks that 3.5 billion years ago, the Earth was an ice ball. They think over the past 3.5 billion years, the temperature's remained about the same. It's gotten warmer for a while and cooler for a while, but not anything like that. It's been pretty constant. Why? Because the biology requires that, and the rocks, the geology seem to suggest that, the whole thing, over billions and billions of years. So you have a problem, don't you? How could this happen? Well, so the question is, how could the Earth have maintained this constant temperature? I put the little bullets on here because I think this is a good argument. I really do. It's a killer. And though there has been a response to this, they argue that the Earth's atmosphere has changed. There have been several attempts at this done in the last 15, 20 years. In fact, the last paper that Carl Sagan wrote, it was a posthumous paper, co-authored with somebody, was his solution to this. And they argue that the atmosphere has changed. One of the easiest ways to change is to change the number of greenhouse gases. You know, you've heard about greenhouse gases, how we're emitting all the CO2. And well, that's a good thing, as it turns out, particularly of the past. They argue that in the past, the Earth had a very... greenhouse gas-laden atmosphere, so it retained a lot more heat and kept it warmer. And as the sun got brighter, the Earth's atmosphere changed through geological activity and biological activity so that you decrease the amount of greenhouse gases at the same rate the sun was brightening, and the two exactly canceled out each other over 3.5 billion years. And you did that without any feedback. That's amazing. Truly amazing that you could have two unrelated events going on, a process going on, so they exactly compensate one another. I used to illustrate that for my students. I would say, I'm thinking of an integer between 1 and 100. I ask a student to tell me their number, and they'd say 17. I'd say, well, I was thinking of number 2, and the number was 83. They sum to 100, don't they? I asked another student, what's your number? She said 50. I said, I was thinking of 52. It sums to 100, doesn't it? Somebody else said 10. I'd say 90. And supposedly I was coming up with a number every time, and they were coming up with a number every time, and every time we did it, it exactly added up to 100. Isn't that amazing? Well, my students were not impressed. They kind of figured out that I was just subtracting whatever number they gave me and getting... But... No, I really wasn't doing that at all. And we're supposed to keep doing this indefinitely. Well, how many times can you do that and exactly balance? And that kind of drives home the point in all of this that you can't compensate for things like that. It's obviously some sort of design thing. If you want to say, well, the Earth is billions of years old, then and God was somehow keeping it all balanced, that's fine. But if you're going to involve God that much, you might as well just say, well, he created all in six days, 6,000 years ago, and be done with it. It's a lot more efficient now, isn't it? So if you're going to take an evolutionary approach to this and keep God out of it, I don't know how in the world you explain this. And by the way, they threw out a solution to deal with greenhouse gases 20 years ago, and then Carl Sagan came along after his death and said, well, it didn't work, so let's try this one, this will work. And then since then, at least two more times, two other explanations, one dealing with dust and something else. Every 5 years, they come up with a new explanation, only 5 years later to say, well, wait a minute, that didn't work, so we got a new one. So they're really desperate. In the last 20 years, I've seen at least four different iterations of different explanations, all dealing with the same sort of idea because the previous one didn't work. So I'm still waiting, all right? I'm waiting for that one that really will work. So where's the evidence for this? Computer models again, all right? They're in simulations, how that might have happened. And again, there's no evidence that this actually took place. Very quickly in the cosmos, so there's some evidences. Spiral structures in galaxies. We have galaxies are vast collections of stars, billions of stars, and not all of them are spiral galaxies. Many of them are what we call elliptical galaxies, but I like to talk about spirals. And I also want to talk about the expansion of galaxy clusters, and hopefully I can get to that before my time expires here. This is a photograph of which galaxy? The Andromeda Galaxy, a.k.a. M31. It looks a lot like our galaxy, we think. Here is the nucleus of the galaxy. Then you have the spirals going way out here to the side. We're looking at it nearly edge-on. You've got two satellite galaxies, little galaxies we think are orbiting around the thing here. You can see some dust lanes in part of the spiral arms. The next photograph shows even a better. This is the M51 galaxy. It's got a companion out here. You got the nucleus here and the spiral arms. Turns out there are a lot of stars between the spiral arms. It's just the spiral arms contain really hot, bright stars and a bunch of other things too. Very nice grand design spiral we see there. If this were our galaxy, we would be about halfway out from the center. We're not near the center of the galaxy. This is what we call a barred spiral. I think these are beautiful. I love these galaxies. Instead of having just the arms come off, the spiral arms come off the nucleus, there's a bar across here, and the arms come across off of that. There have been suggestions for probably 35 years that our own galaxy is a barred spiral. We couldn't tell for sure because we're inside of it. We're somewhere away from the center, and there's a lot of dust that obscures our view in the visible part of the spectrum from looking toward the center. We're about 25,000 light years away. And now we've got evidence from other wavelengths that suggests pretty strongly our galaxy does sport a bar, modest as it may be, near the center. I don't know about you, but this morning I feel better about myself just knowing I live in a particularly beautiful galaxy. And there's the Sombrero Galaxy. This one's a beautiful one. It's nearly edge-on, and you can see all the dust showing up here. The spiral arms don't show up very well, but there's the bulge and the dust we can see along the edge. Well, those spiral arms can't last forever. What happens is things are, the inside is moving faster than the outside because of the gravity involved. And if you do that, you move the inside faster than the outside, then you will smear that out pretty quickly. There was a debate that raged from the 1930s into the 1960s whether spiral arms wound up or unwound. They really had serious debates which way they were rotating, couldn't tell. At that point, they began to argue, well, maybe spiral structure just persists, because you see, if the inside's rotating faster than the outside, they should be smeared out within a few rotations. Really, within a billion years, the spiral structure should disappear. And yet most people think the galaxy is probably 12 or 13 billion years. It's gone around many times since then, and spiral structure is still there. So why does it persist? So I would say, outside figure, galaxies could be no older than about 2 billion years. And again, that's not a problem for a recent creation, but if the universe and the galaxies are many billions of years old, 10, 12, 13 billion, that's a problem. And the response has been what we call spiral density wave theory. That was propounded back in the late 60s and was the straight dope for 20 or 30 years, that there's some sort of acoustic wave that's keeping all this going on, except it didn't really work because in the 90s, they began to say, 80s and 90s, began to say, well, it's interactions with those companion galaxies that drove that. Yeah, that's it. And that didn't really work, so now they're talking about dark matter. You heard a lot about dark matter. I happen to think dark matter probably exists, but it's probably spherically symmetric and won't solve the problem. It's also being invoked to explain all sorts of problems like this. So as far as I'm concerned, there is no viable model to tell us why spiral structure persists. So I happen to think that that indicates that relative youth of these things. And if it's simply gravity driving this, gravity's a pretty simple thing. It ought to be straightforward. It shouldn't take us 45 years and three different models that don't work to get there. It should be really easy to explain. And lastly, very quickly here, I want to show a photograph of a cluster of galaxies. This is the Coma Cluster. There are literally thousands and thousands of clusters of galaxies. Galaxies tend to not just be isolated. They tend to be in groups of hundreds or thousands of galaxies. And a guy named Fritz Zwicky started studying this back in the 1930s. So this has been around for 75 years at least. And what happens here is within a cluster, you can measure how fast these things are moving. And presumably they're doing orbital motion. And as they do orbital motion, you can calculate how much, how long, what kind of orbits they have. And it looks like, if you look at how much matter you can see in these things, there's not enough gravity there to keep them bound, and they seem to be flying apart. And it would take less than a billion years for these clusters to fly apart. And as they do, they would dissipate and be gone. However, people back in the 1930s were talking about some of unseen matter, dark matter. They call it missing mass back then. And so I'm not real enamored with this. I'll close with this one, but I'm not real enamored with it. As it turns out, I think dark matter exists and probably can explain this problem. But if dark matter doesn't exist, we're right back to the problem. We don't know for dark matter for sure exists because we can't figure out what it is. There's some evidence for it. But as it turns out, I think we've eliminated most of the possibilities. And I suspect if dark matter is real, and I think that it is, it consists of a form of matter we don't even know about yet. And to me, that's very humbling and exciting. I'm right on time, I think, Gary, and we'll close with that.